Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello, and welcome to the 7th episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Laura.
And...
Ben.
Today's episode is all about the novel The Martian. And we have interviews with Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, and Mikaela Musilova, who is a space scientist, an astrobiologist. She's just...
amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. We always do a spoiler alert. A few people have said to me that they really want to listen to more of the episodes, but they can't because we always put a spoiler alert out and they don't want to have the experience of watching the film spoiled. And I thought, well, this is a bit different with a book.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the first time we've focused on a book.
Yeah. So, let's have a section at the start of the podcast where we don't do any big spoilers. And then later on in the podcast, we'll do a spoiler alert and people can stop listening and go and read the book at that point. What are your thoughts?
So, in the novel The Martian by Andy Weir, there's a guy and he goes to a planet.
But
in
we're
the solar
not
system.
Sure what planet or what solar system.
Is it really a book?
I think we can be a bit more specific than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I honestly think you could hear absolutely everything about this book and it would still be worth reading because it's about enjoying
the journey.
But we are going to do a section as free of spoilers as we can manage and then we'll do a big spoiler warning and you can just... read it!
The novel, The Martian, by Andy Weir, available everywhere, on every platform. It's available, of course, as an ebook. It's available as an audiobook. It's also being made into a film, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Matt Damon, written by Drew Goddard, coming out towards the end of 2015. I found a nice quote that, for me, kind of sums up why this book has become so popular on a blog by a guy called Dennis Wingo. The Martian is a great example of how technology and human ingenuity are intricately interwoven in the story and how together they weave an exciting tale of accomplishment, overcoming obstacles, and the triumph of survival against daunting odds. In very brief, it's a book about an astronaut, Mark Watney, who is part of the Ares 3 mission to Mars at some point in the future, some point in the quite near future. And as a result of various things going wrong, he gets stranded alone on Mars. The crew of his ship think he's dead. He has lost all communication with Earth, and he has to work out a way to survive.
So, spoilers coming soon. But first, Ben, have you done a poem?
Well, for this episode, Andrew asked me to make a poem using the cut-up technique. Okay, this was, of course... sort of developed in the 1920s by the Dadaists, including Tristan Tzara, and in the 50s by Brian Gysin and William Burroughs. There was a recent BBC documentary, Burroughs at 100, narrated by Iggy Pop. Really interesting radio documentary, lots of cut-ups in that. It was actually played quite recently on This American Life. They named it Burroughs 101. So if you have a look on This American Life website. So, cut-up technique, where you take existing texts, cut them up and make something new. And Andrew suggested that there's so much brilliant language in The Martian, all those acronyms and abbreviations and technical terms. That would be a good starting point for a poem. So I went away and I tried to do it and I realised I really needed some help with this poem. So we're actually going to record the poem live in the shed now. I'm going to go away and edit it, and then the cut-up version will appear in the podcast.
Wow.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
What I did, I went through the book and just pulled out a load of technical language.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
It did cross my mind that you'd physically cut up the book that you're hitting with.
No, I read it on my phone and did just some searches for different technical terms. Yeah. And I've written out some cards. Okay. So I'm going to randomly deal these cards out to Laura and Andrew.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're each going to read different parts. And then I'm going to cut it up, mix it together and see what happens. This is a bit of an experiment. But if it works, you will hear a cut-up style poem here.
1,425 days.
549 souls.
Mars descent vehicle.
Radioisotope.
AL-102.
Aerial regional scale. Atmospheric regulator. External control.
Sol 65. Sol 200. 25.5. 790 Kelvin.
141
byte sequence. 14% energy production. 92 square meters.
368 liters. Condensation point 77K.
1,692 potatoes.
21.5 pirate ninjas.
Sinus meridiani. Schiaparelli.
Acidalia
Plenitius. Mars ascent.
Extra vehicular activity.
Aries 4.
Anything but disco.
Anything but disco.
Anything but disco.
Anything but disco.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. And thank you, William Burroughs and Iggy Pop.
And thank you that you're still listening to this podcast.
All right.
Is there anybody out there?
How did it originally come into the world, this book?
Well, I could answer that, but let's get Andy Weir to do it. We were really chuffed to get an interview with Andy Weir. He was in America when I spoke to him, and I was in the house here in Bristol. So there are a couple of audio glitches because of the internet or something, but don't worry too much about it.
Satellites, rockets passing over.
I think it was something to do with a NASA launch at the time, but don't worry too much about that because what he says is really interesting.
I'm a software engineer by trade. I quit my job about a year ago to go full-time on the writing. I always wanted to be a writer ever since I was a kid, but I also wanted to eat regularly and not live under an overpass. And so I ended up going with, you know, computer programming. And then in the late 1990s, I got laid off from AOL, and I ended up with a bunch of money. And so I realized I could live for a few years without working. And so I thought, I'll take my shot. And I wrote a book. The Martian is actually my third book. The first one was really, really bad. I wrote it when it was in college. Fortunately, I wrote it before the days of the internet. No one will ever see it. It took 3 years off. I wrote a book and tried to get it published. And it's the standard story. Nobody was interested in it. I couldn't get an agent. So I said, like, well, now I don't need to wonder what if. Like, I gave it a whirl. Back to computer programming, which was not like this feat, really. It was just, okay, well, I like computer programming, I'll go back to that. And then I said, like, well, I still like writing. And as the internet got more and more popular, I said, like, well, here's an avenue where I can write and get stuff out to an audience, and so that'll be my hobby.
So he wrote The Martian as a serial, and he put a chapter out every 6 to 8 weeks, and he was doing it for a very specific audience of around 3,000 science nerds, really, who were following his work on the internet.
They must have given him some interesting feedback.
I got a feel for what the readers liked and through omission what they didn't like. And also, like, my scientifically minded readers would tell me any errors. And so I was writing the story really for them. I had no idea that it would have broad appeal. It never occurred to me that it would be anything other than a completely niche story that, like, very few people would enjoy.
And somehow it went from that to a publishing deal, and he sold hundreds of thousands of copies of the book.
The way I bungled into success was I finished it, and I thought, okay, well, that's it. Now on to my next serial. And I got emails from people saying, oh, hey, I love your book, but I hate reading it on a website. Can you make an e-reader version? So that was easy to set up. And I'm like, there you go. You can read it for free from my website, download it for free as an e-reader format, or you can pay Amazon $1 to put it on your Kindle for you. And more people bought it from Amazon than downloaded it for free from my site. It got good reviews, and people posted positive comments about it, and it started working its way up the top sellers list. And then that's when Crown Publishing, an imprint of Random House, came knocking. Everything worked from there. And around the same time, 20th Century Fox came for the movie rights, and the print deal and the movie deal were 4 days apart.
So that's how it happened. And for me, how it happened was, Ben said, read this book. you have to read this book. You will love this book. And why did you think that, Ben?
Because it's a very direct, engaging, thrilling read, which finds a really good balance between authentic technology and science and a really gripping story. It's been described as hard sci-fi. Science fiction, which is really grounded in authentic science, authentic technology. The term was first used in the 1950s, and it came from Analog, a very long-running magazine, Analog Science Fiction and Fact. Astounding Stories, it started as, in the
30s. Nice.
Okay.
And it's a magazine with science fiction stories in it, basically. Stories that often have that kind of technological sort of grounding. One of the editors was John W. Campbell, author of The Moon is Hell, which a lot of people have compared The Martian to. Someone gets stranded on the moon, that person has to survive. It's also been described as not at all hard sci-fi, because of course people have to have a debate. It doesn't really dig into the philosophical implications of the technology, which is often part of the genre as well. Okay. So it's a survival story, more of a sort of suspense thriller with those sci-fi elements. The technology and the science feels really integral to the storytelling. It's someone using their ingenuity, their training. Mark, the hero, is a botanist as well as an engineer, which is kind of convenient, but it really sets the character up to be able to solve loads of really hard problems. And that pretty much the whole book is based around how on earth is Mark going to solve these very authentic feeling problems that are thrown at him. The book's also been compared to MacGyver in the way that he kind of uses various bits of technology, gaffer tapes them together, does a quick calculation, and then works out how to save himself.
I was speculating on how we could do a manned Mars mission. How do we keep them alive when they're on Mars? How do we get them back? How do we do this plausibly without saying, like, oh, we'll just spend $100 trillion on to make a giant spaceship? Now, how do you deal with various failures that could happen on a mission, and how do you make sure that you don't kill the crew? So I started considering, what if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? What if this other thing goes wrong? What if these two things go wrong at the same time? How do you make sure the crew stays alive? So I made one unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of it.
I love a good adventure tale. A hero isn't, like, exploring, and that's what I really liked about this book.
It's massive escapism, and it takes you to an immediate story where it's happening right there, right then, on Mars. There's a guy in a desperate situation, and it's written in that format as log entries from Mark Watney there on Mars dealing with the problems day to day. And I asked Andy Weir about that, if that was a deliberate thing.
If you're reading a third-person narration, or even, in often cases, a first-person narration, you get the sense that this is being told to you, that this happened a long time ago, and you're having it told to you now. In a first-person narration, it's almost like you imagine the whole thing is done, and it's this guy telling you about what happened. But with a log format, everything happened that day. At the time I'm telling you this, I don't know what'll happen tomorrow. That gives you that sense of immediacy.
He did an awful lot of research for this book. I think that's partly why it took him 3 years. It took him that amount of time, because he was doing so much research on it.
But I like doing that. So that's like a hobby of mine. Astrophysics, thinking about manned spaceflight. I just like doing the math and the research. So that part is the part that's fun and easy for me. The hard part is actually writing things. The biggest challenge was trying to get that information across the reader without looking like a Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
And without being boring, and also without overwhelming them. There's a bunch of stuff that I consider really exciting and interesting because I'm that kind of nerd, but I realize, like, most people aren't. And also there are cases where I spent hours and hours doing the math on something and coming up with an answer and going, like, oh, yes, yes, here it is, here's the answer. And I realize it's going to be, like, one sentence. I had to assume the reader only had, like, a layman's understanding of space and space travel. And there's a bunch of stuff they needed to know so that the plot and the events in the story would make sense to them, so that they'd understand why, you know, this is a danger or why that is critical, etc. I wasn't really interested in, like, teaching the reader things. I was just trying to entertain the reader, but they have to know these things in order to be entertained by this story.
I think that in itself is genius, that it manages to keep a reader who may not have an interest in this all the way through. I think it's brilliant. And it did take me a while to get into, but once you're in, you're thoroughly entertained and constantly learning at the same time.
So yeah, it's interesting that he wasn't trying to do science communication, but just by the very fact that he kind of loves it and wanted it to be right, it ends up doing that job. I wondered, did the story come first Or was he just sitting around thinking about science and the story came out of that?
I'm a pantser, not a plotter, as they say.
Oh, hang on a second, Ben. I didn't want to ask him what he meant there, because I wanted to seem like I knew what I was talking about. What is he talking about?
Yeah, he says he's a pantser, not a plotter.
Ah, okay.
This is a pretty common distinction in writing styles. A pantser is someone who just kind of goes by the seat of their pants, follows their instincts, follow whatever the character is telling them, and just writes. Often they'll have to do loads of editing after that. A plotter would be someone who really maps out the structure of their story, the plot, the narrative, in great detail, before even starting writing.
Okay, so he's flying by the seat of his pants.
I knew what I wanted the climax to be and the ending, but I didn't really know how I was going to get there. So I would say, like, okay, here's a situation, so how does he survive?
And in the book, Mark Watney needs food to survive on Mars, so he needs to grow potatoes.
So I started doing kind of deeper research into, like, how would you grow potatoes with Martian soil? And I quickly realized, after doing all the math, that he wouldn't have anywhere near enough water. And so I'm like, okay, now I have to come up with, how he ends up acquiring enough water. And that was, like, turned out to be this major sequence of plot points that I wouldn't have even thought of if I hadn't sat down and done the math and realized that he would need a lot more water. Science drives the plot. Also, sitting down and doing the math on, like, power consumption and, like, the needs of, like, how to keep his rover functioning and stuff like that turned out to make things really interesting.
There is so much technical detail that comes out in the language of this book that you get used to it. You get used to EVA and the Mars Descent Vehicle, the MDV, and the MAV. The Mars Ascent Vehicle, you get used to all those things, and the writing kind of trusts you to kind of to go with it. Once it's been introduced very briefly, he doesn't give you a huge blob of exposition on each of those things. He just kind of expects you to hit the ground running and go with that stuff. But it really creates this very textured writing.
And it transports you into the world in a much more realistic way than it would do otherwise, I think.
The detail really gives back to the reader. Once you kind of invest a bit of time thinking about, okay, what is exactly going on here, the suspense is built through all those technical aspects working together, and you kind of see, yeah, of course he needs to get this many potatoes by using this much soil and this much CO2. Okay, how's he going to do it? It becomes like the technical details become narrative.
I find myself backing him from the moment go. That you just wanted him to survive, and you wanted those potatoes to grow, and you wanted him to keep on going, partly because it was such a good story, but at the same time you really feel connected to him because it's just him.
The character of Mark Watney is quite sarcastic. He's taking culture references from all over the place. He's using language in quite a loose way. So he feels very relatable in that way. He doesn't despair all that much. He just kind of deals with it and then talks about whatever's going on in his head, comics, TV, music. So it does create a very engaging character. How much of that do you think, Andrew, is based on Andy Weir himself?
Well, what I actually said to him was, is Matt Damon playing you?
Largely. Mark Watney is certainly based on my own personality. I'm definitely a smartass, and I like to think I'm resourceful and stuff, but I'm not as smart as he is. I guess what I would say is he's all of my good points. He's better at all the things I'm good at, and he has none of my flaws. Any book's main character is someone the author wants to be or someone the author wants to screw.
Okay.
For the record, I would like to be Mark Watney.
I look forward to reading the next book.
Next book has a large ensemble of characters. It didn't go where I wanted.
Okay, we're going to go into spoilers now. Well, soon. We've been saying that we're going to cover this book for a while on the podcast. You've had a chance to read it. You've got no excuses. If you haven't read it, very naughty. Go and read it. Alternatively, since you're listening to a podcast, you might well be into audiobooks. And if you are, you can go to Audible and download this book. And here's Andy Weir recommending just that.
Audiobook's great. I highly recommend it to anybody who likes audiobooks. Bob Bray is the narrator. R.C. Bray is his name, and he did a great job.
And a bit of news, guys.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
This podcast is now supported by Audible.
Oh, great. We can be like all the other podcasts now.
Yes.
Oh, thank goodness.
I know.
We're in the podcast gang.
Which gives us the opportunity to say this. If you go to audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed,
you get a month's free trial of Audible, which will allow you one free audiobook download. And we would, of course, recommend that you download The Martian by Andy Weir, but other books are available.
But download The Martian by Andy Weir.
Give it a listen.
Take about 10 hours.
And then come back and you can listen to the spoiler section. To be perfectly honest, you can get a month's free trial of Audible whatever you do. You don't have to go to audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed to get that free trial. But if you do, you'll be helping us out. So we'd really appreciate it if you did that.
You should find a really nice place to listen to the book in. That's what you should do. And then you forever fall in love with that place even more.
Where did you listen to it?
Up a mountain in Austria. And it was amazing. Surrounded by snow, clear blue skies, listening to The Martian.
Did you put some red-tinted sunglasses on?
I had skiing goggles, so it was pretty much the same.
And I listened to it fairly regularly on a bus. And I can tell you it's just as good on a bus.
You started dismantling the bus too.
Exactly. There was duct tape everywhere.
Well, I kind of wasn't. That's the thing. I wasn't on the bus. I was on Mars with Mark Watney. We need to bring in Michaela Musilova at this point. I don't really know how to say this, but she's just got back from Mars.
Yeah, so I always call it fake Mars, but it was basically a Martian simulation facility called the Mars Desert Research Station. It's in Utah, in America, in a desert, which really looks like the Martian landscape. Beautiful red kind of sandstone hills, and the missions are usually in the winter time, so it's actually frozen there. So when you're part of the mission, you really think like, I'm on Mars, because there's nothing for miles around. You feel really isolated and surrounded by this beautiful red desert.
We also need to do the spoiler warning.
Spoilers! Coming! Now! Hang on, why? Is Michaela in the book?
Well,
is that a spoiler?
No, she's a space scientist, as we've discussed. She was also asked to review the book for lots of Slovakian newspapers.
As a scientist, whenever you watch a sci-fi film or read a sci-fi book, you have to kind of close one eye to some of the inaccuracies. Otherwise, you just wouldn't enjoy it. So there's so many films where I'm just like, I didn't see that. I didn't hear that. Let's just move on. But I must say, the author did a great job of researching. The way he described the people, say, working at NASA was great, because having worked there, I can say they are very much like that, or a lot of them are like that. And having gone to a simulated Martian mission, I can tell you a lot of the work that Mark did in the book was very much something we did. So, for example, he was the botanist in the crew, and so was I. I was in charge of the green hab. The facility itself has three buildings. One is the habitat module, which is where everyone lives and works. You know, it can get quite cramped and difficult to be in at times, because you're constantly interacting with people. You have almost no alone time. And so that was one of the issues we had, and I'm sure future missions might have. And then on the bottom floor, there are these biochemical labs and the chambers to exit into the outside world, where you put on your spacesuit before you enter Mars. The whole time you really need to think, I'm on Mars, I'm going to do everything like I would do it on Mars. The pressure differences and gravity, we obviously couldn't simulate, because that's still far in the future to get that kind of technology. But for example, the spacesuits are very heavy to carry with the air supply pack as well. So, you know, it's difficult to move around. And again, it kind of gives you that feeling of what it would be like really on another planet. The next building is the green hab. So that's the greenhouse we had. And the main purpose of that is for these missions to try and grow plants and vegetables, herbs for the crews. Obviously, that's a long-term project, because it takes a long time to grow things. But again, it is to simulate what it would be like one day on Mars, when people actually have to grow their own food. And you can also do some biological experiments in there. The whole time you're kind of monitored for various psychological tests, and they are part of one of the main goals of this whole Mars Desert Research Station, to see how people would work together. But actually, the design of the habitat module is based on a proposed mission to Mars, where this is exactly what a kind of habitat module would look like, and that is the kind of space people will have to live and work in. I really fully submerge myself into this simulation. So, and since it was my dream since I was 8 years old to become an astronaut one day and do this kind of space science, for me it was living the dream, literally. Like, every day I was ecstatic. I was just so happy. And even though we were cramped in those spaces and we had to eat horrible astronaut kind of dried food, and you know, there were a lot of unpleasant things about it, but I got over it because I was like, ooh, I'm on Mars, I'm enjoying this, I'm wearing a spacesuit, yay, I'm looking for Martian life and things like that. So when you really get into the kind of state of mind, then it's great. And for someone like me who's always wanted to do something like that, it was almost like a holiday. I was actually very pleased with The Martian. Of course, there were a few things I had to close maybe both eyes to. I found it a bit silly. So, you know, they send him there with like grass and, you know, he's meant to grow some things, even though their mission is like 30 days. So it was completely pointless. Why would you send someone there to try and grow things and then just leave after 30 days and not come back? I mean, these things take a long time. So if you actually want to start, you know, building greenhouses and things on Mars, which is a plan, I think, for the future, you need to do it gradually and maybe send the missions to the same spot to continuously work on these projects. You can't just send someone there with potatoes to grow within 30 days. So, I mean, it worked for him because he was stuck there for much longer than 30 days.
Which is fortunate, I guess.
One thing I liked was the description of the crew. And so I think the commander, she was a geologist, and at times he was describing the kind of work she did, and I'm also part geologist. And so it was like, oh, yes, I did that kind of thing. Oh, that's actually correct. Good job, Andy. Good job of getting that right. And also personality-wise, she was actually very similar to me. There were some characters that were maybe obsessive-compulsive about things, and again, you very much get that. Others that just can't tear themselves away from the work, always in contact with mission control or whatever, and the way they were communicating with people on Earth, the whole Capcom and quite formal language. But it's true, it's very much like that during our mission. Even though, you know, I would write emails with these people on a daily basis several times, I could never just sign it as Michaela. Would have to be Greenhab Officer Musilova. And I found the formality to be quite ridiculous, but it's true that that's how it is, how it's meant to be.
The reason why that's in the spoiler section is because that is one of the best moments in the book for me, is when that the moment where the book opens out from just Mark on Mars and you get NASA back on Earth, and just this sort of relief that he's not alone. And they're working it out. It's just a brilliant moment.
The focus shifts from one person trying to survive to basically the entire world looking at this one human on Mars and throwing everything they possibly can to keep this one person alive.
When I was reading it, it felt like the NASA that I know from reading books and watching documentaries and things about NASA. And it's interesting to hear from Michaela, who's actually worked at NASA, and that it is, you know, genuinely like that.
So Andy Weir must have done a lot of first-hand research. He must have visited NASA and JPL.
He actually said that because he's worked in sort of technical labs and things, and he just transposed that to NASA, and it worked, you know. So maybe it's just that type of person that works in those places.
Yeah.
And the environment that
they're in. In the film, of course, it's only 2 hours, 2.5 hours. There will be more of a balance between Mark on his own and NASA and JPL. There kind of has to be. They've got Jessica Chastain as the captain of the crew, Kristen Wiig as Annie, who's the kind of constantly swearing press officer, Chiwetel Ejiofor as Venkat, Jeff Daniels, Donald Glover is in there as Rich Purnell, the guy who...
The
Rich Purnell manoeuvre. Donald Glover from Community, brilliant. So, Ridley Scott directing, obviously, Alien, Blade Runner, can't argue with those. The last time Ridley Scott went into space was Prometheus.
It's a bit of a concern, isn't it?
A bit of a concern. But if they can sort of pull off that balance of having the sort of fast pace back and forth in the NASA scenes.
The log entries, I think that's something that will come across really well in the cinema. It'll build the tension really nicely.
It's a built-in narration kind of tool. Also, it'd be really interesting just to have the first 30 minutes silent in the style of Wall-E, really.
Yeah, of course.
If Ridley Scott really wanted, and Andrew Goddard really wanted to trust the audience to go with it, you could have a really arty, interesting film of just, you know, just watching Mark, maybe just muttering to himself occasionally. But just going through all that, I think that would be fascinating.
I'm just really worried about it. When you love a book that much, you're always scared about what they're going to do with it with the film. I can't imagine how Andy's feeling about it. Well, I did actually ask him.
They have some really amazing talent on it, and having read the screenplay, I'm very happy with, like, how the story is going to go. They did send me the screenplay for comments.
Oh, great.
And I gave my feedback, and they made some changes based on what I had to say and ignored others. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a really good job. The screenplay was adapted by Drew Goddard, who you may know as the director of Cabin in the Woods. He wrote Cloverfield. He wrote a bunch of episodes of Lost and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I can't talk about the screenplay. People always ask me, oh, how much is it like the book? I can't really, I'm not allowed to answer questions like that. Yeah, right. But I can tell you that I'm very happy with it, and I think it's going to be great. I mean, sure, anything could go wrong, but mostly I'm just impatient. I have to wait till November.
I know. Tell me about it.
It's killing me.
I don't think the film of The Martian would exist without the success of Gravity. Lots of technical details. It's all about problem solving. It's based in authentic technology. You can see where they're coming from. The production company are probably hoping that this is going to be the next Gravity. It's going to have some of that buzz. And I think they could learn a lot from Gravity, the way that Gravity trusted the audience, that they don't need tons of exposition, they don't need tons of backstory.
Yeah, it's quite funny, actually, because both Michaela and Andy had a bit of a problem with Gravity.
Gravity, it was amazing, the effects, and that was great. I was upset about the portrayal of the main character, because, of course, the fact that she's a woman and they make her seem very incompetent, that's unfair, and in this day and age I think it was really inappropriate, but it was more of the fact that whether it would have been a woman or a man, that they tried to make out that she was a complete rookie that just didn't know how to do anything, and without George Clooney she would have been completely screwed. And it's just, no, astronauts are these amazing people who work, you know, years, even decades to go out into space, and they're trained to deal with anything and everything, and of course they can't predict all sorts of problems, but they are prepared to deal with as many problems as possible. So to show that, oh yes, she's an astronaut, yet she doesn't know how to do anything, panics and needs the help of someone else to actually get through things, was really unfair, I think, to the astronaut community, and was not a correct portrayal. But otherwise, the scenes and the way they managed to show everything, you know, from space was absolutely amazing.
So I really enjoyed it because I'm into space and astronauts and a space shuttle and the International Space Station. I mean, it had a bunch of glaring science problems, right? Mm-hmm. And so that they did bug me, but as I'm watching it, I'm like, okay, most people wouldn't know this, so I'm just being nitpicky. The problem is actually coming up with scenarios that would endanger astronauts but not immediately kill them. You say like, oh, the space station has a problem. Well, what's the problem? Oh, it got hit by an asteroid or a piece of debris. Okay, they're all dead. Well, let's say it got hit and it has a leak. It's going to fall apart. Fine, they all get in the Soyuz capsule and go back to Earth. Really, really smart people thought through all these scenarios before they made the ISS. And so anything that doesn't kill the astronauts pretty much immediately, they're going to have an out. What I call it is the hard science fiction uncanny valley. You know the uncanny valley with robots? If it doesn't look much like a human, then if it's like a mannequin, then you're not bothered by it. As it starts to look more and more realistically human, you get really creeped out. And then if you got something that looked actually human, you'd be uncreeped out again. So there's this area where you're close to correct but not quite correct, where it's worse than just being really far from correct. And that's how I feel about science fiction. One of the things I like is orbital dynamics. I actually worked out the real orbital trajectories that they would have taken in The Martian. I wrote software to help me with it. All that stuff is accurate. It bothered me in Gravity that she kept getting hit by the debris field over and over again. So it's this protagonist seeking debris field. And they said, oh, it happens every 90 minutes. It's like, well, if you're in ISS's orbit or something like that, yeah, you'll go around the Earth every 90 minutes. If the debris field is moving much faster than you, which it was, right? There, it was colliding with them at hundreds of meters per second, then it would be in a different orbit. It would go faster. Now, it could intersect you at one point and, like, trash, say, the space shuttle. But then because it's going faster, it would have a different orbital period. And so by the time it came back to where it had been last time, Sandra Bullock would be in a completely different part on her orbit, and they wouldn't intersect again. Unless they happen to be a resonance orbit, you know, it goes around twice, or she goes around twice for every one time it goes around, or something like that. And it's just like, that bugged me. But admittedly, most people don't know that.
I think Gravity comes to mind, doesn't it? But what film do we think you would like The Martian to be like? Mission to Mars?
We agreed, Andrew. that we would never discuss Mission to Mars again. For the Gravity episode, Andrew and I decided to do some extra research. We wanted more excitement in space, and a film that popped up in Andrew's radar, I don't know what defective radar, was a Brian De Palma film called Mission to Mars.
Yep. I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's got Gary Sinise doing some fantastic, intense work. That's about it. It is, however, there are some highly scientifically accurate scenes in Mission to Mars. A jetpack scene where they're in space and they can't save one of the characters, which is probably much more technically accurate than Gravity.
But much worse.
Much, much worse. Much, and just so worse. Devoid of tension or emotion or anything.
Yeah. I honestly think that scene is a perfect example of why science shouldn't be in films. Because
well, hang on.
No, it's so bad.
Don't watch Mission to Mars. Imagine watching Mission to Mars 5 times. That's 10 hours of your life.
Yeah.
Take those 10 hours, listen to the audiobook of The Martian, or read The Martian. We're doing you a massive favour.
We really are.
I mean, I can't imagine anyone watching Mission to Mars 5 times. It could happen. It just could just happen to you. You could be stuck on Mars, and the only DVD you've got there is Mission to Mars. If you are in that situation, try and set up some kind of comm link to audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed and download the audiobook to The Martian. Please don't put that DVD. Don't even put it in. And don't even think about watching the special features of Mission to Mars.
Okay, so we know what film we don't want it to be like, but I did ask Andy if there was a film that he thought it sort of in his head it should be like.
Well, Apollo 13 is a good example of, like, you know, you're in trouble, you're in space, and all the science is accurate and matters. And it's also, like, man versus nature, so kind of Castaway. I've heard that a lot. People say, oh, it's Apollo 13 meets Castaway.
Yeah. That'll work.
Makes me look like a really big Tom Hanks.
Which is also fine, you know. There's no
yeah, problem. Yeah, yeah, I like Tom Hanks.
Friend of the show, Tom Hanks, I think that fits perfectly.
Yeah. And Apollo 13, of course. And you'll never guess who else loves Apollo 13.
Who?
Michaela.
It's been ages since I've seen it, but I remember there was a scene where they send scientists at NASA into a room and you're like, okay, here, you have only these things, use them to solve this problem. And that's exactly what it would be like in space, which a lot of filmmakers unfortunately forget about.
NASA JPL, or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, is, to anybody who's interested in space, pretty much the coolest place on Earth. It's where they create everything. When Michaela was working there, that was when they were working on Curiosity. And so, well, I had to ask her, what's it like to work at JPL?
It's difficult to say, because, again, you go in there, yeah, thinking, you know, it's like the future. You enter this new world, and it's not like that. I mean, it is just another kind of business science park kind of area. There's, you know, no futuristic architecture or anything amazing. And what's actually funny, it's built into the mountains above LA, so you get deers just walking around campus. And if you are in some of the bits that are further away from the main entrance of the campus, you get like mountain lions attacking people. It's like, oh no, don't leave the campus alone after this hour, you might be attacked by an animal. And it's like, in JPL? Really? It's like, there are a few things like that which are a bit quirky, but otherwise I was actually really pleasantly surprised that the people were fairly normal.
Yeah.
And again, you know, every now and then you get some eccentric character or people with their tics and so on. Yeah. But otherwise, you know, people were actually very friendly. Since I was a child, I always wanted to do something like this. So I've basically been working since I was like 16 years old to get to something like this. And with time, all the internships and experiences started adding up, and I got selected to go to Caltech, a university in America. At the time, it was the best in the world. And that's when the first time I actually got to do proper astrobiology research. So working with organisms that can survive in extreme conditions, extremophiles, which are the kind of life you could potentially find somewhere like Mars or other planets and moons. And then from that, I got a scholarship to work for NASA. And that was a great experience. At the time, they were preparing the Curiosity rover to send to Mars. So I got to work on projects directly related to that.
Oh, wow.
And I actually put my signature into Curiosity, so it's currently on Mars.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, wow.
And so that was obviously a huge step for me, because the experience as an 8-year-old that really inspired me to go for this was visiting NASA Goddard Space Center with my family and putting on a spacesuit. And so now I actually got to work for NASA, so that was, again, a dream come true in a way for me.
And speaking of the Curiosity rover, it's just found water, liquid water, in the soil of Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Which could have helped Mark quite a bit, actually.
That would have been good, yeah. But then when I had all that fun with the potatoes and the CO2 and those explosions in the hab and all,
yeah,
it would have been a bit boring, really.
Yeah. Absolutely.
From then on, I came back to the UK to finish my master's at UCL, again in astrobiology, looking at microbes that can survive extreme radiation. It's the sort of thing you would find on Mars. We have very high levels of radiation there. And then went on to my PhD, where I was looking at extremophiles from glacial environments, so that can survive on glaciers and ice sheets in polar environments, but even, say, in the Alps, other places you get glaciers. And the research there on those microbes, I found that they're basically capable of producing a lot of organic matter, despite the really difficult conditions they live in. So I thought of a project to kind of try and apply these extremophiles to fertilizing soils, and not only on Earth, where you could use it in deprived environments, but for terraforming Mars, so creating Earth-like conditions on Mars. And so I proposed a project to go to the Mars Desert Research Station with this research, and then I also applied to be one of the people on the crew, and I think all my experiences from NASA to going on expeditions to Greenland, working in extreme environments, all those things helped me get chosen to be on the crew, and then ultimately got me to Mars. But I always tell people, it's not the end, you know, that's just fake Mars, you know, there's always real astronaut and real Mars, so hopefully one day.
I don't know how old Michaela is, but she's not old enough to have had the experiences that she's had already. I asked her what she's doing next, and, well, this is what she said.
Well, actually, I have a few options at the moment, potentially to work for NASA again. They're preparing a rover, Mars 2020, and other missions in the future, so I would really like to be able to work on projects like that again. Yeah. At the same time, I was recently offered a position to lead my own lab in Slovakia. They're setting up an astrobiology center, the very first one, which is an amazing opportunity, because usually to go from a PhD, you then have several postdocs and so on. It usually takes about 10-15 years to be able to have your own lab. And if I could just skip all that, it would be absolutely amazing. And Slovakia just recently started a cooperation agreement with the European Space Agency. So we're really just now starting all the space research and everything. So it'd be a great time to be part of that.
Mars, rover, NASA, your own lab. How does somebody get to that choice in their life?
I think we're going to be covering the film of Michaela's life pretty soon in the Cosmic Show.
I think you're right.
Jessica Chastain is there.
Yes.
She's down for it.
I must say, seeing how slowly things are developing, I'll probably be a grandma by the time people are actually sent to Mars, but at least I wouldn't mind going on a one-man mission at that point. I'd be like, I have nothing to lose, you know. Yeah. I can die on Mars, I don't care.
Is it something you'd like to see move quicker, or do you...
Of course, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of people now, they think, oh, we have the technology, we should do it, but it's true that we don't actually really have the technology. I mean, I think if there was more investment in science in this area, we could get people to Mars in 10 years. But there's not enough money, so that technology just can't be built. And the same goes for science. We know a lot about the dangers on Mars, but haven't been able to elaborate on how to protect humans against it, basically. So with more investment and hopefully not too much time, we will actually be able to send people there.
Andy Weir did actually have a question for you. And it was, if there was or is microbial life on Mars, do you think it's more likely to have been sparked from the same thing that life on Earth was, or a second biogenesis?
Yeah, I mean, there are many answers to that question. The time when Mars had flowing water, or at least we think so based on the evidence, was about the same time when life started on Earth. So it's very likely that if within similar kinds of conditions life started here, then it could have started on Mars. But of course, you know, where did it come from in the first place? Did it just... was it chemical reactions that led to the formation of RNA and then DNA and so on? Or was there something like an asteroid that hit both planets at the same time? And added life there, or maybe did an asteroid rebound from Earth to Mars, or the other way around? Are we actually Martians? I think the only way we would ever find out is if we do find life on Mars, can look at the genetics and then can see, is it really similar to terrestrial, also Earth-like life, or is it something completely different? And then we'll know that maybe just a life on both planets started independently, or maybe, you know, a different asteroid from a different solar system, a planetary system, hit Mars, and that's where life came from. I think the conditions on Mars were clement enough in the past, so, you know, nice enough for life to be able to start and maybe exist for a few millions of years, or maybe longer. So I'm hopeful that once it, you know, it might have actually existed, and then hopefully it might have hid underground when the conditions got worse on the surface. And so maybe even today it might still live somewhere, but we're talking, you know, hundreds of meters, if not more, underneath the surface, where radiation and other problems wouldn't be an issue. But of course it has been, you know, a few billion years since the water stopped existing on Mars, so maybe the microbes just weren't able to survive that long. But I think if we're going to find it somewhere, it's going to be in the subsurface, not really on the surface anymore.
The Martian is full of loads of authentic details, and all the technology feels completely real. But how plausible is it for a botanist to survive, or anyone for that matter, to survive for that long on Mars?
Well, that's being looked into at the moment, actually, because on the International Space Station are Scott Kelly and Mikhail Korienko, who are going to be on the International Space Station for 1 year.
Wow.
And nobody's been up for that long.
That's
before.
A long time.
Yeah, and they're looking into all the effects that that has on humans. And actually, Scott Kelly's got a twin brother, and they're sort of testing him in comparison to his brother on Earth. Yeah.
Brilliant.
And it's all with a view to lengthy human spaceflight, and particularly, although this is probably just a PR angle, but particularly the possibility of travelling to Mars.
The time dilation effects and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, but I didn't know this until this happened. But did you know they have movie nights on the International Space Station?
Of course they do. I mean, how would you survive otherwise?
Scott Kelly tweeted a picture of him watching a film the other night. Guess what film it was?
Mission to Mars.
yes, but he didn't tweet that. He was too embarrassed. So he tweeted a picture of Gravity. And we'll put a picture on there. We'll link to the tweet or something. Put the picture on the website, because the picture shows the screen that he's watching Gravity on with Sandra Bullock in the fetal pose, and then the point of the International Space Station. So he's watching it at the same point that happened.
That's a bit close to home, isn't it?
Yeah, you would think so. It's like watching snakes on a plane, on an aeroplane.
With a snake?
Yeah, is snakes on the International Space Station out yet?
I imagine it's coming really soon.
Let's just hear from Andy Weir one more time. When I rang him to do the interview, he was actually working on something then.
Of no use to your listeners, because this is an audio podcast, but this is what I've been working on lately. I've been playing around with Minkowski diagrams, which is these deal with simultaneity and dilation of events at relativistic speeds. That's just for fun. But I've always had a fascination with relativity. I've always wanted to find a way to present it such that it makes sense. It's very complicated, and it just seems like we're looking at it the wrong way, and that there should be a way that we look at it. You know, if I went back in time 10,000 years and told someone, okay, if you were to walk that direction and just keep walking that direction, you'd end up back here.
Yeah.
And it's like, how would you explain to someone, you know, it's like, no, so what happens is everything's connected, and you go around, and in any direction you go, you'll come back here. And it's like, that doesn't make any sense. But if you said, oh, we're actually living on a ball, then it all suddenly starts to make sense.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a way that there's got to be some elegant way to look at relativity such that it makes sense, but I haven't found it.
Sunday morning is just sitting there going, right, so how am I going to work these diagrams out? And thinking of a way to communicate relativity. Let's hope he does it. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Because I don't understand it. I'd like to think I understand it, but I don't. So if you like him on Facebook, he's actually worked out how often you find yourself between the moon and New York City. When you get caught between the moon and New York City, I know it's crazy, but it's true. If you get caught between the moon and New York City, the book The Martian, and presumably in the film,
if they can get the rights.
Yeah. Mark Watney is stuck on Mars with somebody else's iPod, and it's full of disco. As a result of the moon in New York City situation, and my YouTube thing being set up to carry on playing songs, even though I don't want it to, Hall & Oates came on. And I realised that that is the music that I would least like to be stuck on Mars with.
Maneater.
Yeah. Because it makes me want to dance like a dad. And I just had this image of me dad dancing in a Mars spacesuit to Hall & Oates, and that being the moment that they came to rescue me. Right. And there's like this, the lasting shot of me in everybody's imagination. I'm there dancing to Hall & Oates in a spacesuit, and you can't, you know, dad dancing looks brilliant normally, but in a spacesuit you get a bit constricted, it's difficult, and I could just imagine this vision that the whole of Earth has of me forever, having been this Marsonaut. I'm suddenly the guy who's dad dancing to Hall & Oates in everyone's mind forever. She'll only come out at night, lean and hungry tight. Nothing is new, I've seen it here before. I can't be on Mars with Hall & Oates.
As much as you love them.
Watch out, boy.
Wonderful image. I think the world would embrace that.
Oh, almost forgot. Where did we go today, Ben?
Into space.
Pretty much, yeah. So we went to the new planetarium at Bristol, the science centre here in Bristol. It's the first 3D planetarium in the UK. If you can get to Bristol in any way, you should and go and experience this. It says on the website, you fly through Saturn's rings. And I was like, no, you don't. But you do.
In 3D.
In 3D.
If you've got this far in the podcast and still haven't read or listened to the book, I don't think we've spoiled it that much. The book feels like it could be used as an instruction manual for how to survive on Mars, but never loses sight of the story and the suspense and the character.
Go and read it.
Or listen to it at
audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed. Thank you very much to Andy Weir, and thank you very much to Michaela Musilova. Just brilliant. And thank you all for listening. I don't know where we go from here. Well, actually, I do know where we go from here, because coming up in future episodes, we're going to look at Jurassic World.
Oh.
And we have an interview with Andy Day from Andy's Dinosaur Adventures.
Brilliant.
He was in the shed today as we record, but in the future he'll be on that. He's a time traveller. That's what he does. If you want to watch some films, which we will be covering in future episodes, Gattaca, Silent Running, Avatar, Jurassic World.
All the Jurassic Parks.
Apart from 2 and 3.
Yeah.
If you'd like to find out more, you can
follow us on Twitter, at The Cosmic Shed.
Find us on Facebook.
Visit thecosmicshed.com.
Find us on iTunes and a whole bunch of other podcasting platforms, including Stitcher and Player FM.
But now, you can actually see inside and outside the shed on a video.
We have set up a Patreon page. Patreon is a crowdfunding site, a bit like Kickstarter, but where you can support shows or podcasts on an ongoing basis, so you can make small pledges to us, to The Cosmic Shed, every episode. So we might finally be able to fix the roof.
And the floor, and the door, and the windows.
Yeah, yeah. We'll just
it's move. Authentic.
There'll be a house here. It'll be the cosmic the cosmic house.
And here we are from the Cosmic Chateau.
We love making this podcast. We spend a lot of time doing it. So we set up our Patreon page. You can find it at patreon.com /thecosmicshed.
If you do nothing else, go and watch the video, because it's silly.
And it's really good.
And you should see what the shed is like inside.
Yeah, so have a look at the video.
Think about helping us out.
Yeah, that'd be great. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Can we make that as a bonus video for the pledge? $108 a month to see Andrew dancing in a spacesuit to Manita by Hall & Oates. We will send, if you pledge anything, I'm going to send you that video.
Make me do it first.
There's no question that's happening. We're gonna source a spacesuit. It's gonna happen.